Alright, welcome back to Decades on Dirt Roads. This is Catherine.
And this is Maddie.
And today we're going to introduce Renee, who...
Renee, I had the opportunity to work for her a couple summers ago in dispatch. But she's worked as the center manager for Blue Mountain Interagency Dispatch Center for quite a few years and has helped out a lot with the Casualty Assistance Program and the CISM group. And so that is her current position right now. But... definitely a conversation that is heavy in all the right ways and needed ways of the reality of this job and the downfall of the risk that we take. And she really has a skill of comforting people and bringing order and closure and logistical support in a lot of different ways to people when a death occurs or when something really unfortunate happens. But she cares through and through, and to have worked for her and have the opportunity to sit down with her was really special for me in a selfish way, because I really look up to her and her leadership role and the way that she cares for people from top to bottom.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people we've chatted with in regards to Renee have really said the same thing. She's just a solid point person. Like, if anything's going wrong, she's going to be the one that... is going to come there and pick you up. And she also fought fire and has been married to a hotshot soup. Like, she's lived the life through family and being a dispatch.
Mm-hmm. And she's lived through the eras of all the things that we're working on as an agency in regards to that work-life balance concept and caring for people outside of their capacity to hike, dig, and fight fire and do all the things that this job asks us for. She's lived through all the different personalities of being super hardcore and not caring what a person's middle name is and just caring that they're a number and they're showing up to work to having emergency contacts to knowing through and through who a person's, you know, family is and what's important to them. And she's helped a lot of people through their own dark times, and it takes a really special person to be able to hold people up in really dark times. So I have a ton of respect for her and all the work that she's done. She's regionally known, nationally known, and she's incredible. So I felt super fortunate, and Catherine and I loved having our conversation with her. So thank you, Renee, and thanks for listening. We're really excited for this one.
And we're live.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being with us, Renee. We'll go ahead and have you introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Renee.
And what do you do? And yeah, what do you do for your day job?
Right now or before?
Start from the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, no, not for... Hi.
In the beginning.
In the beginning.
And then there was Renee.
In the horse and buggy days.
No.
So the last, 20 years, I've been a dispatch center manager here at Blue Mountain Interagency Fire Center. And as a collateral duty, probably the last 5 years, I've done casualty assistance work for the Rio Washington office. And I just recently took a detail to do that more permanently, I guess you could say. So that's my day job now, is I'm working for the Washington office and taking care of folks.
Gotcha.
When bad things happen. So started fighting fire 112 years ago. So fire's been in my life for a really long time. So started as a 16-year-old firefighter for the state, one of the first women to fight fire for them. And yeah, it was a really long time ago. Didn't have Nomex. I wore denim jeans and a denim shirt. It was really cute.
But sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we did have a hard hat, though.
Did you get the onesie like Bill Mitchell talked about?
No.
Yes.
I'm not as old as Bill.
I'm sure Kathy will tell him he said that.
Yeah. No, a lot of history in fire, good and bad, and it's kind of brought me to where I am today.
Gotcha. So with that being said, your spouse has been in fire for quite a while. He's now retired, but can you kind of speak to maybe how you guys met in the industry and what that's been like growing with a spouse in this line of work?
Well, I've been his favorite dispatcher for a lot of years.
Certainly.
And that's how I met him. Yeah. Previous life, I moved to Western Oregon, and he was a firefighter there. So spent a couple of years working there and ended up going to COC, Bend. He went to school in fire. I went to school in fire and for a couple of years. And then we got married. I had Callie and he took an adult job in silviculture. He got out of fire and because we had Callie and he needed to grow up and that didn't work, but
how long did that last?
Yeah, not very long. Yeah. Anyways, in 1994, he was on the Redmond Hotshot crew. Cause he really, really missed fire and wanted to take an assignment doing that. And so spent the summer with Callie. She was, 4 years old. And that was a really, really difficult summer. Mm-hmm. He was sister crew, the Prineville Hotshot crew. And they were in Colorado at the same time as Storm King Mountain and actually had breakfast with Prineville. And they didn't know where they were going to be going that day. And the last conversation I had with him was, you know, we're here together and we're going to, you know, don't know what fire they're going to send us to. And that night I started watching on, I think it was CNN, seeing that they were saying that 54 firefighters were unaccounted for on Storm King Mountain. And probably one of the longest nights of my life.
Oh my God.
Trying to figure out where he was at and if he was there, if he was okay, at the same time knowing that there were people that were not okay. And I didn't find out anything until he called the next morning and said that it wasn't us. But I don't think I've ever felt so much guilt in my life because I was so relieved that he was okay. But I felt so bad for all the families that woke up that morning with a lost loved one. So it was tough. It was really, really tough. And then, you know, bringing them home to Redmond and attending the memorials and it was a tough road. Mm. So yeah, after that, he decided that he wanted to stay in fire. And so he took a squatty job, went from a silviculturist to a squatty and on the LeGrand Hotshot crew in 98. And we moved back over here. I grew up here. So my mom and dad were here, and knowing that he was going to be gone a lot, it was an easy move for us. So we came back home and started out as a squatty and did years on the crew, ended up as the superintendent for several years, and 21 days out, you know, the assignments were really, really long. Hard to be a single mom for 21 days.
Certainly.
Look forward to him coming home for about a day. Mm-hmm. And then that whole, I swear to God, there were times that we wanted, it's like, well, you come home, go to a hotel for 4 days, unwind, do work through what you needed to work through, and then you could be present with me and Callie.
At the end of the season?
No, at the end of each assignment.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was so hard for him to switch gears. I mean, mm-hmm. he'd come home and sleep for 2 days because he didn't sleep while he was, you know, out on assignment, and it was just a really difficult transition. Mm-hmm. Loved seeing him, knowing that he was home, but he was never really home because that other family was there, and that other family was the crew.
Right.
And wasn't as bad when he was a squatty, but when he was a superintendent, he felt a huge responsibility to them. And so we'd have him for a couple of days, and then it would shift and be thinking about the next assignment and the roster. And yeah, so super, super proud of him for being a hotshot. I mean, it felt really good. I was really proud of him in that way, from a firefighter perspective and from a professional perspective. It was pretty cool what he was doing, what he was seeing, the changes he was making, hearing that, you know, the crew was doing great. But from a spouse perspective and from a mom perspective, it was really, really difficult.
Certainly.
Really difficult.
And from that 1994 year, where were you at in your career?
So it was interesting. In 1989, I dispatched for a few years in Western Oregon, and was pretty, how I was invincible as a firefighter. I just was. I mean, yeah, I was stupid, but I was. And I never thought, as long as I was on the radio, that anything bad was going to happen to anybody. And because I had that idea as a firefighter, too, that, you know, all the bad stuff happened to other people because they were making mistakes. They were not, you know, they were not being safe, and learned a hard lesson that way. But when I was dispatching, I got sent to a large fire that had just started south of the town I was living in, and was taking a comm trailer out, and I was just jacked. I could see the column. It was mushrooming out. I was jacked to be going out. And so it was going from a type three to a type one, burning homes. There was a lot going on that day. And that night I got a call from a mom that was looking for her son. And her son and his brother, or cousin, I can't remember what the relationship was, had gone back up to get some logging equipment out. And in my naivete, I said, oh, I'm sure they're fine. I'm sure they're fine. You know, it's, we got good people in there. We got everybody out. I'm sure they're fine. A couple hours later, this guy's brother called and was asking the same question, and my reply was the same. It was almost flippant. You know, it's like, oh, they're fine. You know, they're going to show up. Well, the next call I got at 5 o'clock in the morning was from somebody that found their bodies, and I needed to call the sheriff to let them know that we had two down. And that night broke me. All this bubble or whatever I built around myself, believing that everybody was going to come home and everybody was going to be safe, just completely, completely broke me. So did the rest of the season. It was a hell of a season, a lot of fire, a lot of fire. And that was before we went to Central Oregon, and I was done. I got out of dispatch.
How old were you?
Oh.
You couldn't have been that old.
In early 20s,
yeah.
mid-20s, oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. So I was done. So I got out of it, had Cali, and then 94 happened, and I felt like that maybe if I got back in, I could make a difference. And so in 98 is when I got back into dispatch, and I started out as a dispatcher for your dad, burnt powder fire zone, and yeah, so I started as a initial attack dispatcher. I think it was a GS4, GS5, temporary, and worked my way up.
Look at you now.
Yeah, look at me now. Old and gray. But no, it was a journey. It was really a journey. Had my own critical incident with when I was as an engine captain, went to an airplane crash, and we were told that the area had been cleaned and by the corner, and we got out there and started mopping up and putting the fire out and found body parts. And it was a family of five, and I was 17, and at that time we never talked about it. We never talked about it. My supervisors didn't talk about it to us. I didn't talk to my crew about it because I was a woman, the only woman, and it's like I wasn't going to show any weakness or vulnerability. And so we didn't talk about it. Started having nightmares, started doing really stupid stuff to numb myself. Went back to my senior year in high school and was really messed up. Still not dealing with it. Went back that next season, and one of my crew members asked if I was okay. And that just kind of opened the door because they saw how much I was drinking. They saw, you know, how much I was partying, and I was doing my job great. I was still a great firefighter, but the rest of me was really, really messed up.
Right.
So it took years. It took years for me to get over that.
I don't think people realize the stuff that firefighters end up doing because you are kind of that first response.
You are.
And, like, I know my husband, when he worked in Ukiah, they were responding to house fires, crashes,
yep,
lost semis, like, all that stuff. And no one thinks, like, when you have that uniform on, no one thinks, oh, these are kids.
Yep.
These kids are 18, 19, 20. Like, they can't, you know. and you're asking them because they put on the green pants to be a first responder, that's something they didn't sign up for. They're just, they have the IQCS and they're in a rural area and that's all they have.
Yep.
And yeah. I think people forget that like a lot.
Yeah, I think we're a little better at it, but I still have a lot of conversations, you know, preseason stuff with fire managers saying, hey, you know, we don't talk about this stuff enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to, because we will break these kids because they're just kids.
Yeah.
I mean, they're out here to earn money to go to school. Some of them are, you know, going to make a career out of this and they're going to be fine. But there's going to be some folks that don't do well with what they just saw.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we help them work through that? And I think we're better at that. But, I forgot the question. But that's how I got here.
That's the beauty of this stuff.
Yeah.
This conversation. But you bring up a good kind of turning point in a conversation. But you speak to a lot of different situations and events that you went through as a young person. And you now in a WO position, in a leadership role, and you have been. I can confidently say that you've probably always been a leader in your own way, but now that you're a point person for the CISM groups and for entities that you guys bring order to real chaos, not just logistically and physically in a landscape, but emotionally. What have been some key things that you've looked to teach people and some key things that you've grown into in those positions of things that you want to get out and teach people? Or some principles?
You know, it's for me, the reason I continue to do what I do is for lessons learned. If I can share what I've gone through, if I can share what I've learned from others to the young people coming up and giving them a little bit of perspective from my lessons learned, hopefully they won't go down the same road I went down. So that's been huge for me, is I talk a lot about my lessons learned and try to be pretty vulnerable about how messed up I got by not getting help. So the lessons learned is huge. And even in the dispatch center, it's a big deal to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk a lot about the what ifs, and I'll sit in my office all day long, and that's my job. I what if.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's the closest life flight to this emerging incident? Where's, you know, what if this? What if this? And so getting prepared, being prepared for that what if is really, really important to me. And just knowing that stuff can happen in an instant. And if you're not prepared, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be behind the eight ball because you're trying to think of what to do instead of automatically knowing what to do because you've practiced or you've thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, lessons learned and being prepared and just really honoring the space that you're in with the people that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really, really blessed with a really good group of people, really good group of people. And it's made my job so much easier. I know, you know, there are people that don't like me, they don't like my approach, and I honor that, you know, I just do, but I think I am who I am,
right.
And I don't do anything intentionally to hurt anybody, and if I do, I'm sorry for that, but it's like, sometimes I just gotta be Renee,
yep.
And sometimes that's too much, but you know what, I am who I am, and I can't forgive that, you know, it's
right.
Like, yeah. And I've been, you know, and your dad is part of this. I've been so lucky with my bosses. They have let me be me.
Mm.
They've let me be Renee, and they've trusted me to do that. And they've trusted that I've got the backs of every firefighter on the ground, and that my people in here have their backs. And no matter what might fall out of my mouth that might be inappropriate, beyond that, they know that I'm going to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but allowing me to grow the way they have all allowed me to grow has been huge. So they've let me take risks. They've let me do the casualty assistance program as a collateral duty, which was huge. So having good supervisors that trusted me was was huge. And I think for me, what I've learned from them is that I give the same back to my folks.
I was going to say, you're the living, breathing example of what it means to walk the walk and talk the talk.
Oh, thank you.
As a supervisor.
I was going to say, do you want to mention that you used to
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, all the stuff when you talk in real life on a Monday morning, you know, Renee's the first one here. And we know that you're thinking through things, and we know that on a busy day when we're all suiting up to be initial attack dispatchers, I mean, working for you for 6 months, that holds true 100% to the support that we know that when our eyes are looking a little bit like deer in the headlights, Renee's already 14 steps ahead of us. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's going to be just fine, GS4. It's going to be just fine. This is a busy day. You do a great job of that.
Thank you. It means a lot coming from you.
With your position going into that SISM, what did that mean to you? Because has that always been an avenue? Have you kind of been a pusher to initiate that program? Can you speak to that?
Yeah.
And what that stands for.
So I always believed that if I did everything right and if the people around me did everything right, then we were going to bring everybody home. Nobody was going to get hurt. And I believed that for a long time. Even after the incident in Western Oregon, I came back into dispatch knowing that, well, if I do everything right, I'm going to be okay. The reality of it was that I was going to a lot of memorials with Will. He was losing his buddies on the fire line. But again, it was something that was happening outside of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, with somebody else. And it wasn't until Willie had flashover burnover with LeGrand, and he called me one night. I was the assistant center manager, and he said, Renee, I've got three down, and we're lifelining them out to Boise. And that bubble that I'd built around me, the bubble that I'd built around him, because I trusted him with my daughter's life, and I trusted him with this crew's life, and something just happened to them, that bubble completely busted. And for him, too, because he took his job really, really seriously. Mm-hmm. So our response to that event as a forest was not good. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know the best thing to do for the employees. We didn't know how to support their families. Our emergency notification forms were non-existent to be able to call a mom and dad and say, hey, you know, your son or daughter is hurt and in the hospital. So I got really frustrated, really scared, because I knew after that anything could happen at any point in time. And so I had heard about a class called You Will Not Stand Alone that was being taught in Region 5. And I asked my force supervisor at that time if I could go. And he said yes. So I went down to this class. It was a class built out of the Esperanza incident where they lost 5 firefighters. Mm-hmm. And the San Bernardino National Forest built this class based on their lessons learned from that. And so I went down to the class, built a critical incident response plan when I got back, and then actually brought You Will Not Stand Alone to Region 6. And so that's how I got involved with the casualty assistance program and understanding hospital and family liaisons and peer supporters and all the stuff that we could do and do well if we were prepared. So that's how I got into it.
Mm. What has that meant to you to see that program evolve in this area?
Everything. You know, I think knowing how badly it could go and knowing that we can't recover as an agency if we do it wrong, it's meant the world to me. The reason I'm doing what I'm doing now in the detail is to try to keep the program attached to the ground, because it was a grassroots effort from the very beginning, and there's a lot of influence from people that have never been on the ground. And so my hope is that as long as I'm around, I will keep it attached and will continue to do what is the right thing to do for the ground. And not what looks right, but what is right.
Right.
So, yeah. I'm trying.
Yes, you are. Night and day.
Yeah.
With all, you know, with all that sadness, and it's just real. Also, you talk about being prepared. You got to be prepared for the worst. How do you find the good?
You know, the good is the thank yous. The good is knowing that you've taken a really, really horrendous time for a family, and you've given them a little bit of breath. Mm. And so it's a lot. I mean, I'm, you know, from a regional perspective, it was, you know, we had stuff going on, but from a national perspective, somebody's always dying. You know, there's always an off-duty death or a traumatic injury or whatever. And so that scope is a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. So trying to figure out how to balance that and see the good, it's that piece of it. It's like we are making a difference in families' lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we miss sometimes. Right. I know we do. Mm-hmm. There are times I feel like a hypocrite when I'm teaching you will not stand alone in that whole statement of you will not stand alone, because I think we've left people alone. And it's not just because of our program. It's because of DOL. It's because of all the bureaucracy that we have to jump through to get them help. But so just really trying to focus on the good that we're doing, even if it's just a small piece.
Right. That keeps you helps going.
It. Yeah, it does. It does. And knowing that we're riding a ship that was going the wrong direction in a really big hurry. Mm. So, yeah.
Can you speak to, you talk a little bit about balance. How have you come to balance your own stories and your own vulnerability, and then being able to bring organization to a lot of different emotional chaos?
I think it's because I've experienced a lot, and it takes a lot to phase me just mm-hmm. because of my slides. And I think I know that if I can't be calm and present when stuff is going down, then I'm not doing my job. Mm. So for me, that's, you know, I mean, I could be sitting in here in the office and hear all kinds of stuff going on, and I can feel my heartbeat going up and going, okay, here we go. Yeah. Take a deep breath and go out, okay, kids, what do we got?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's just...
That is exactly how you say it. Can quote directly. Okay, guys, what do we got? Maddie's shaking. I don't really know what's happening right now.
It's all good. Mm-hmm. We got this. Yeah. Mm.
So then what do you do to decompress?
I suck at it.
You sign up for another job.
Yeah. No, I do. Yeah, it'll give me a little bit more. No, I'm not good at it. And, I mean, to be completely vulnerable, work has been my life. And the idea of retiring is really, really scary to me. And I know somebody in your life that gets that. Mm. It's just, yeah, I mean, this is what I do, right? I've always worked, always.
Right.
And the idea of not working. We didn't do vacations in the summer because we were always fighting fire. We didn't ski in the winter, you know? So, yeah, my poor Callie's always called herself a fire orphan. So... Yeah, no, I mean, it's something that I'm very, very aware of. And, I mean, I spend as much time out in the woods as I can. That's where I get my breath. That's where I get my peace, is in the woods. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so we do that as much as we can. But, yeah, no, I'm not real good at it.
Mm-hmm. It's okay to still be learning.
Exactly.
I know, yeah, I have a few years left. So.
You know. A few years, you got lots of years.
Plenty of time to figure it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't quite grown up yet, I don't think, so we'll see.
Nobody.
I
really
told
does.
Willie the other day, is that I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up, and it scares me. At 64, so.
Not a chance.
Yeah.
So with all you've worn a lot of different hats. What have been some of your favorite moments? That's maybe a weird thing to say with you being a manager of a dispatch center that typically gets handed really chaotic things, but what's, you know, what have been some highs for you?
Oh gosh, seeing that GS4 dispatcher with really big eyes dispatching a handful of fires, and at the end of the day look up and they smile, and it's like, yeah, yes. I knew you could do it. Mm. That's pretty cool. That's really cool.
can attest, you do feel accomplished. Day is ended.
So I really like that. The work that we've put into the interagency relationship here, it's been a lot of work. There's really, really good people. And I think that this area leads in that relationship based on what I see in the rest of the region. So that's really cool.
Certainly. Yeah, that's something you got to be proud of.
Yeah.
You've put a lot of time into that.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Holding the babies of the dispatchers that have come through here over the last few years. Yeah. It's amazing.
That's awesome. To come full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's some of the best advice, or what's some advice that has stuck with you that's been given to you from supervisors as you've come to grow in all these relationships and be a point person, not only for the region, but obviously for this place locally and then nationally? What's some advice that you've always carried?
I don't know if I get, well, I know I didn't get this from supervisors because they'd probably say that's not true. But, for me, it's like, never lose your voice. I didn't have a voice as a little girl, and bad things happened. I didn't have a voice as a young firefighter, and bad things happened. And so finding your voice, not losing it, not being afraid to speak up, even in an environment where you think you shouldn't speak up. It's like, I don't have an issue calling the regional forester and saying, hey, this doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. Or this doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. So I think keeping your voice, recognizing perception is everything, perspectives are everything, and what you might be seeing is different than what the other person is seeing, and maybe this time you can let your right go and listen to their right for the good of the order, you know. So that's huge for me, is just, I fought real hard to find my voice. Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to have to fight that hard. Everything I've done, I can't do by myself. So surrounding yourself with good people, and my supervisors have always allowed me to do that. They've trusted me to do that, and that's been huge. Mm-hmm. Huge. I'm a big picture gal. I mean, that's where I function from, and I suck at details. So I've got people in the office that do that detail thing, and they do it really, really well. I'm like up here looking at, okay, what's going on? And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank God for those people. And it's the same with the casualty assistance program. And I mean, doing big picture stuff, but I'm not showing the data, you know? It's mm-hmm. like, well, I don't care about data. How do they feel?
Right. Not a number scale.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I think those big picture people make really good managers.
Mm, thank you. I agree. But you really got to have people that take care of you too.
Yeah.
And I've been really, really, really blessed with that. Really blessed. People have taken good care of me.
Certainly.
Yep.
Yeah. Treat people how you want to be treated.
Yep.
You put everybody first.
Yeah. I get it back, though.
You do.
I get it back. Mm-hmm. So, what else?
So, with this being called Decades on Dirt Roads, we like to hear advice because, you know, you spent a lot of decades, like, seeing really cool places.
Careful.
But, yeah, sorry, I need to rephrase that.
You spent at least one decade.
At least one decade. You've had a really unique career where you've supported all those folks that have gone out into the field. And so what advice do you have for the next Renee or the next center manager or the next initial attack dispatcher? What advice do you have to the next generation of people that you want to be supporting as you have paved the way?
Remember how to play. Hmm. I was always serious.
Was,
yeah. No, I think remembering how to play, and that there's always a time to laugh and, you know, just be silly and not taking everything so seriously that you don't do that, that, you know, you remember to go out and smell the roses or the dandelions or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to keep it light somehow.
Yeah. My, I think your dad knows this, but my folks manage Boulder Park Resort. It was a resort up in the Main Eagle Wilderness. Before it was a wilderness, there was a lodge and cabins. And I was like in the third and fourth grade, and my younger brother was in the first grade. And so I spent my summers up there. And we were too young to work. And so mom would feed us in the morning and say, we'll see you tonight, get home before dark.
Yeah.
And so I played so hard then, the exploration and just fishing and rolling rocks off the hill and, yeah, doing all kinds of really fun stuff. So I think that's where Renee began, was that, I mean, I had to be tough. We had to survive, right?
Right.
So, right. Yeah, so, yeah, I look back at that now. And it's like, God, I would never let my daughter do that. But, yeah, they were trying to make ends meet, and they didn't need us in their hair. So it was like, yeah. Yeah. So remember, I mean, for me in the next decade, remembering how to play and remembering that little girl again and the joy she found and just the, you know, just the simple things. So, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of joy in rolling a rock down a hill.
Oh, I know. I love it.
I think it's so funny because...
It's incredible.
I know.
It never gets old.
No.
Because then you like, find one rock and you're like, it, like, satisfies the itch.
Oh.
And then you walk a little bit further and you see a bigger rock and you're like...
I bet I could roll that.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
attention,
I know.
Getter. And then the person you're with, it's like, what if we moved that boulder? What if we...
You want to know something funny? Bill and me used to have so much fun doing that. We would try it up on top of Lake Pilcher. There's that one meadow that people, like, no one camps in it till hunting season. And we would just be on the edge and try and roll rocks into the meadow.
Yeah.
And then, like, Bill, how old was Bill? Like, 61, 62.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, man.
This
what
is
a,
incredible.
What a job.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Tim and I, my younger brother and I, would go up and do it. And we were fine until... We were kind of at a trailhead.
Just dropping rocks.
Yeah. Well, it made it a little more interesting. Do you think you can hit this one?
Yeah.
Roller.
I know. Yeah, we kind of got in trouble, so we had to move our rolling place. But, yeah.
And too many hikers.
I think this is the second episode that we've yelled roller.
Yeah, with Kelly? Is that the one we talked about?
No, it was Olin. Remember when he got that Scarface fire? He got hit in the face twice.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh.
He was hiking, and they were hiking in the dark or something, and his chainsaw was slipping because he had, like, chainsaw, two bladder bags. Or no, on his nose. Broke his nose
once, and then
a kid above the hill lost his bladder bag. Rolled, perfectly hit metal piece.
Oh, no.
Broke his nose again.
Oh, no. You can do anything to me but touch my nose. Don't ever, yeah, oof.
Double whammy.
Oof. That makes me want to cry. Yeah.
I don't even think he went to the hospital that day either.
Probably not.
No, because he said he went and fought fire. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, the other, what was that, last weekend we did that? The weekend before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember to play.
Yep. Remember what brings you joy. It's easy to lose that.
Talk about how you've learned to take care of people. The different ways.
Nice vague question.
It's open. You're a big picture gal. You can take that wherever you want.
Well, I think I was really codependent growing up, so... Taking care of mom and dad and trying to keep the peace. Seriously.
Are you the oldest?
No, I'm the middle child.
Oh, yeah. Interesting dynamic. We're both the oldest.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, So that was my job. I needed to try to keep the peace.
Gotcha.
I'd buy candy. In grade school, I'd buy candy. I'd run down to the store at lunch and I'd buy candy for kids and... just give them candy. And I remember Kenrick's dad, actually I went to school with Kenrick's dad, and and he had a horrendous sledding accident up on Morgan Lake and was paralyzed from the neck down from that. I remember going over and seeing him in seventh grade. And they've just always been that caregiver, I guess. So, not sure where it comes from. But
natural.
Yeah, probably. I think the codependency thing is what it's all about. But.
Where it's rooted from.
Yeah.
We kind of talked about you coming up through the ranks, but can you speak to any pivotal moments in your career where you've been dealing with teams or big fires or big complexes? Like when you think about being a center manager, there's like one memory where you're like, oh my gosh, we had all these things go on. Good, bad, or indifferent. It's a dealer's choice.
You know, for me, and all the chaos, being able to do our job and to take care of each other is what stands out for me. Mm. You know, when we have to medevac a firefighter in the middle of stuff going on, and everybody knows their job and they do it well, and that's their focus, and we get them off the hill safely and get them to care, that's what makes me feel good. Mm. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, fire on the hill, smoke all around us. If we can keep it simple, take care of the people that surround us, and not get caught up in all of this, then that's where I feel like I'm successful. Mm. So, 'cause you can get sucked up in it in a heartbeat. And so I try really hard not to feed into drama. There's no drama in caring for others. There shouldn't be, there can't be, because you get sucked up into it, and just really focusing on, you know, trying to take care of each other and do your job in the best way you know how to do your job. So, yeah.
We appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you guys very much. This is cool. And I think remembering that everybody, remembering that you never know where folks are coming from. Mm. And you've got to show them grace until you know them a little bit and understand that, you know, they could be being driven by something really bad going on at home, or they've had a rough day or whatever. So showing them some grace, and it's like, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, we all have a reason to be where we're at.
You're so wise.
It's just because I'm old.
No, you're young. You're young fried chicken.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, hopefully you can use some of it.
Unedited.
We've got people on a wait list waiting to hear this one.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Mm. Yeah, I know. That's bad.
And as always, like, subscribe, give us a review, shoot us an email, and remember to get outside.